Hello, listener. As you know, we are in the habit of doing a London-based quotation at the beginning of each episode. I have one man from Hertfordshire and one man from Elephant and Castle with me.
Cam ye o'er frae France, cam ye doon by London, saw ye Geordie Whelps and his bonny woman, were ye at the place called the Kittle Hoosie, saw ye Geordie's Grace riding on a goosey. The hell is that?
I'd keep it going
if you like.
Go on. Do it, yeah.
Come here, frae France. Come here, doon by London. So your Geordie Whelps and his bonny woman. Were ye at the place, Cattle Kitty Hoosie? So your Geordie's Grace sliding on a goosey. From a Jacobite song alluding to George I's fondness for visiting brothels.
Emails of complaint, please, to info@londonistoutloud.com. So as usual, I've opened the front door and grabbed the first two likely-looking Londoners who happen to be out there.
It does seem that everyone's got a story to tell.
I think screaming does help as well.
Ooh, yes, the Horniman walrus.
They dug out bodies in 1887, 1873.
What did he look like when he came out the other end of that?
Knackered.
Got Sarah Palin coming. How do you feel about that?
A little bit pathetic.
So we're in the parlour of Dr. Johnson's house.
One sees a story that is both of protests and of coming together.
So they're banning people from bringing food to homeless.
Yeah, they're banning soup runs.
You know, we weren't buckled by the tailors.
A word in your eye, don't worry or push. A step in the gate is worth two in the bush.
Which area of ridiculousness do we start on with that story? Why would you give a medal to a pigeon?
Listen, you're all idiots. You don't understand culture or anything.
No running, no throwing. This is pretty serious stuff.
You engage with other people, you link across to other people.
It's just huge. It's gigantic.
How many times have you done this so far?
That depends.
What do you think of that approach?
I think that's terrible.
London life is a really rich experience, and there's a lot that's good about living
Boris
here.
Boris Johnson.
He weighs as much as 40 school children.
What a peculiar conversation. Hello, it's Friday, December the 7th, 2012. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe, and this is Londonist Out Loud, a podcast of news, views, and curiosities from London, UK. You can download the show free on iTunes, hook up on Facebook at Londonist Out Loud, or tweet me at Londonist Sound. Well, later on we'll be finding out what two judges, three nuns and a monk have been doing in the past week's news. With me here at the Horniman Museum in Forest Hill in South London, Paolo Viscardi. He's the Deputy Keeper of Natural History here at the Horniman. He helps to keep a blog and runs a biology Q&A site on the side. He also handles geology, osteology, paleontology, collections, as well as overseeing an aquarium down in the basement and all sorts of other things. We'll be talking to him about the Horniman and, of course, the Horniman walrus. Jeff Marshall is the former holder of the record for visiting all the tube stations in one day. We did all stations in 16 minutes, 43 seconds, which was 14 minutes shy of the record, he says.
16 minutes, 16 hours.
16 hours.
That didn't sound very realistic. That would be incredible.
Well, you heard it here first. Just over a quarter of an hour to visit all the tube stations. He's also a London blogger and an independent freelance video and filmmaker who excels with event pieces, news items, corporate DVD productions and website videos. He's also got some watches if you want to buy one. Hello, Jeff and Paolo.
Hello, how are you?
Good morning. A pleasure to be here again.
Well, in fact, when you say, again, your last visit to the Horniman was, in fact, when you were, what, 10 years old?
I'm older than I looked. I just turned 40. It would have been in the 1980s, and we used to live in West Croydon. And my mum, hello, mum, said, come on, son, it's Saturday. And she promised me sort of animals and a forest hill. And being a 10-year-old kid, for some reason, I got into my head that we were going to visit a big swamp with dinosaurs. And instead, there was just lots of bones. And so I think my mum bought me like a plastic dinosaur the week later to kind of make up for my actual lack of seeing a real dinosaur.
We've come through the Natural History Hall, I guess you'd call it, and there's clearly a gallery up above it with lots more exhibits that we haven't yet seen. Of course, the most striking exhibit as you come into the Horniman Museum, as anyone will know who's been here, is the walrus, the Horniman walrus.
Everyone loves the Horniman walrus. He's massive. He's brilliant. Got to love him. He's from Canada.
What can we say about the walrus apart from that it's larger than life size?
He's an interesting specimen. He's a fairly young male, which we know because we've got some information about where he's collected from. He was collected by a guy called Hubbard. And we know that when he was stuffed, the taxidermist had never seen a walrus before. So he's remarkably rotund is probably the best way to describe him. He's a bit bigger than he should be. It looks like the taxidermist has seen a seal and thought, this looks a bit like a seal. Let's just keep stuffing him until he looks like a seal. Nice tight skin, you know, slipping around in the water like a graceful, elegant ballerina, rather than a big lumbering creature with big folds of skin, which it uses as armour when it's fighting. So, not quite the same thing.
Around the walrus, there are a plethora of other creatures. Shortly, we'll be doing a bit of a tour of some of them. What sort of thing are you particularly looking forward to showing us, Paolo?
The trouble is, there is no one thing which is more interesting than something else. It's just a case of what you find interesting. So for me, I have lots of different sorts of interests. So I'm interested in osteology. I like bones. So anything which is skeletal, I'm fascinated by. We've got great ape skeletons along the side next to the walrus, and I find them absolutely fascinating because you can see direct analogues with kind of human morphology, very, very similar in structure. I love this place. I love it.
And that comes through. It sounds as though there might be some consolation for the childhood disappointment here, Jeff.
Well, I'm only here, as I say, briefly today for the podcast, but when I came in the entrance just now, I'm thinking I should email my mum at the weekend and say, how about I take you back to the museum and we could sort of do it in reverse? That would be nice, wouldn't it? So I think a trip back is on the cards.
I feel like I've done a lovely family service already.
So you're making our family bond. It's like a social service you're providing.
Yes, I've always thought so. What about the building itself? Because it's quite an imposing structure. I didn't really know what to expect when I came here, but there's a whacking great big clock tower, big square thing. Has this building always been a museum, or was it something else previously?
Yeah, no, it was custom made as a museum. It was designed and built by Charles Townsend, I think it was. And it was actually built because Horniman's wife, Frederick Horniman, was a collector. He collected loads and loads and loads of stuff. He loved collecting stuff. He built up a collection that was just too big for their house, and he got that time-honoured response, either the collection goes or I do. And so the collection went, and it went here. It went to a custom-built building for the museum collections so that it could be made available to the public. And that's basically what Horniman did. Frederick Horniman provided a museum. He provided all the specimens to populate that museum for the public, and it's been a free museum open to the public since 1904.
There's quite a few of these Victorian gentlemen who went around collecting strange objects. You of course think of Mr. Welcome and plenty of others. What was it about the Victorians that liked to do that?
They didn't have TVs. It's a simple solution, really. Basically, you're talking here about intelligent, educated people with money, lots of money. You know, the Industrial Revolution worked very well for quite a few, well, for a fairly small number of people, but it worked incredibly well for them, incredibly wealthy people, and wanting to be able to put something back into the world. So they often built up these huge collections and then used that as a way of exploring an area that they found interesting. So with Henry Wellcome, it was exploring medicine as a way of understanding culture and kind of human progress, as it were. With Horniman, it was more about exploring the world around him. So it started off very much with natural history, lots of insects and things like that. But because he was a tea trader, it started becoming a lot more cultural as well, so anthropological objects started becoming part of his mainstay of his collecting.
Jeff Marshall, it seems to me that what you and Paolo have in common is an idea for the aesthetic and presenting things. You do video work, of course. What's your first impression of this place?
It's one of those places where I think Paolo said when we came in, they only had a very small amount of the collection actually on display. So it's easily one of those places where you think you could come back and see, you could come back a second time and see something that you didn't see the first time. And I do like those places where, you know, you don't get bored of them. You can constantly go back and be like, oh, I didn't see that, and just, you know, and you learn and you just sort of take on board information and new facts, and that's always a great thing. Do you say it was free to get in as well? I didn't realize it was free.
Yeah, it's free.
Well, why would you not come here when it's free? It's that simple. Come here.
Now, are you a frequenter of museums?
No, I do. My girlfriend works in the museum industry, and I mentioned I was coming to the Horniman, and she was like, oh, we should go. And I don't know why we haven't been sooner. So we have been. We were at the, just randomly at the weekend, we went to the London Museum, saw a film there, had a look around. So, you know, I love London. That's why I'm on this podcast, isn't it? Because I love London. So yes, I don't not frequent museums.
But what an endorsement.
Well, it's just that I feel like I should probably do them more than I do, but I have to also eat and live and earn money. But I just, you know, I wish there was more time to learn about our history and culture and society. And I just wanted to say that the reason why the Victorians were brilliant, when you meant just now, is because they didn't have Twitter and Facebook to distract them. And I honestly believe this is a true. I was down the pub the other night with my friend. Is that I think that once there'll be there might be a phase in about 20 or 30 years' time where, you know, the children that are growing up now that have been brought up with the internet don't get distracted by that, and there might just be like a whole generation where they actually use the internet for something useful rather than just idling their time away. That's what I believe is going to happen.
That's very fanciful thinking, isn't it?
Nice idea.
Are you suggesting there's going to be a great cultural gulf then because of these technological innovations?
I think we're in a phase where you know, things go in revolutions, don't they? And we're in a phase now where there's a lot of technical innovation, and there might actually come a time, you know, later in this century where all the technical innovations come to a stop, and we're just in a phase of utilising them properly and efficiently, and we may have another great sort of time when we go, right, chaps, we've got nothing to distract us, so let's get on and create something or build something rather than be in a phase of learning and discovery, which I feel that we are in at the moment. Does that make sense? Or does it sound like I'm talking rubbish?
Well, I'm interested because both of you are prolific tweeters. We get a tweet every week from you, Paolo, with an article. You're usually holding up a bit of a bone or horn or something and say, right, I challenge you to figure out what this subject is. Jeff, you're often on Twitter. In fact, you very inadvisedly tweeted that you had no emails in your inbox just recently and promptly received lots of emails from people saying, there's one for you.
The first one was from you saying, hello. And I was like, thanks. Thanks very much. I know.
if you will brag.
but you see what I mean? I'm a party to my own thing that I just said. I'm a victim of my own. I think, oh, I have no emails. I'll tweet about that. Why do we do that? It's a silly thing. Why aren't I actually going away and being more constructive with my day?
Yes, collecting objects.
Absolutely. I think it's a nice idea that we will kind of learn to deal with the technology that we have and actually start applying it more sensibly. And I think that's, you know, something which we will do. But the trouble is that we will also come up with new things all the time. I don't think that it's a case that we will have this sudden expansion now and then it will stop. I think every new technological innovation leads to more technological innovation because you're able to do so much more in the future. So I think it's just going to get worse and worse and worse.
What about, as somebody in your line of work, Paolo, the whole Twitter thing seems to have gone hand in hand, whether there's a causal link or not, I don't know, but hand in hand with an inability to pay attention to anything for more than about 3 seconds. And of course, museums traditionally are places where you have to engage with the object, do a little bit of reading, soak it in. And we've seen strategies from various museums, kind of hands-on type stuff, which I know you've got a bit of here as well. But how much of a problem is it capturing and keeping the attention of people as they visit?
With Twitter, I find that actually it's incredibly valuable for in-depth information sharing, because normally when I get a tweet from someone, I follow a lot of people. There are often links to really interesting articles, scientific papers, or something which is looking at a news article or whatever. So actually, I find that those short little snippets of information lead on to a much deeper level of kind of refined research. But it's a way of pre-refining my research to a certain extent, because if someone's sharing it and it's someone who I know shares interesting stuff, it means that it's already gone through a selection criteria for me. So in some ways it means that you can actually focus much better on a particular subject or topic that you're interested in. And I find with museums or with any other kind of object-based, you know, experience, the objects themselves are the fascinating things. So, you know, the museum as a whole is effectively a big, it's almost like a big Twitter stream. It's loads and loads of little kind of snippets of information. Every object could be viewed as a little snippet of information. But as soon as you actually stop and look at one, you can start seeing more and more detail. You can start understanding things deeper and, you know, with much better quality of understanding.
So tweets as gateways, artifacts as gateways. Yeah, it's very interesting seeing these different ways of using Twitter. One new way which seems to be gaining momentum is to be tweeting historical events. We had the fire at the Houses of Parliament tweeted in real time not so long ago. And we've had a new one in the last week, in fact, Jeff.
We do indeed. I I'm quite old, but I'm not old enough to remember the Great Smog of London tweeted by Climate Action, with a two in the word action, because it was back on Wednesday, a couple of days ago, was the Great Smog of London, which lasted from the 5th to the 9th of December back in 1952. You know, you couldn't see more than an arm's length in front of you, and it killed over 10,000 people.
Which yeah, I was astonished by
amazing.
That.
10,000 people just to die. If that was happened, that would be like a major earthquake-style disaster. And yet in London back in the 50s, that's how many died.
10,000 people made ill. I don't think they
okay, well...
died.
Okay, the quote is that up to 12,000 are thought to have died, but no, but up to 100,000 were made ill, which is an incredible number. In the morning, they started at 7 o'clock and they live tweeted with the hashtag Great Smog as the voice of an ordinary Londoner, talking about, you know, the atrocious weather conditions in that day. There were 400 tweets that came out and you could sort of follow the action. It was great.
I wonder which events would be suitable material, perhaps those within our memory would be suitable material for this sort of live tweeting thing in the future.
There was this, because I remember back at the beginning of the Olympics, my Twitter feed was exclusively all about the opening ceremony, and that's what it was. And there was humour and witty insight, and also a lot of smart observations. And I remember thinking, you know, I follow what 200-300 people. I remember thinking everybody that I follow on Twitter tonight is just talking about the Olympics opening ceremony, even for people that weren't in London. And that's an amazing thing. You suddenly felt like it's so cheesy and cliche, but it did bring the world together because everybody was looking at the same thing at the same time. That was amazing.
Talking of people looking at the same thing at the same time, it sounds as though a floodgate has opened and we can hear a clamour of particularly school children, I think, in the background there. What a lovely sound that is.
Yes, indeed. We do have quite a lot of noise from the kids coming to the gallery. And it's sometimes it's fantastic because they sound really enthusiastic. Other times it's not quite so good because it's very, very small kids who come in and just scream. And it echoes beautifully in there. So I think they like it for that. But it's fantastic when you actually get enthusiastic voices coming, floating up into your office space. It's nice.
We should say something as well. The thing that astonished me when you told me, Paolo, was that the objects on display currently form just 1%. You mentioned it yourself, Jeff, just 1% of the total collection. And you're going through a sort of a process of re-cataloguing these articles?
Well, it's reviewing what we have in store, really. What we've got, we've probably got, this is just for natural history, we've got about 2,500 objects on display in the kind of gallery spaces out here. We've got about 250,000 objects in total. So we have vast quantities of material. Obviously, we can't show it all. Some of it's not really suitable for showing because it's, you know, it doesn't look very exciting. Some of it's very, very scientifically important. So we have type specimens, which a type specimen is basically when someone describes a new species, they take a sample of that species so that other scientists can look at it and actually check to make sure whether something that they've found is the same species. It's basically how we have an understanding of what life there is on the planet. That's what museums hold on to. That's kind of what we do. A large part of what we do is not all we do.
Yeah, you've got a gift shop as well.
Yeah, absolutely. But those kind of scientific collections we probably wouldn't want to put on display because they are getting used for research and because they're irreplaceable. So they're kind of a bit too important to put out in a public space where they can be stolen, damaged, or even just because they can't be looked after quite as well as they would be in storage.
You guys are all generalists here, so you're bringing in specialists?
Absolutely, yeah. So, like I said, we have 250,000 objects, and there are two members of permanent staff here in natural history, so you can imagine that we need to know a lot about a lot of different things. Unfortunately, that means you can't get the depth of knowledge that sometimes you need to really make a good assessment of the importance of an object. So, what we're doing as part of this project, it's only going on for a year, we're calling it BioBlitz, and it should be good fun, and it's actually, we've got a Twitter stream on it, called Horniman Reviews. So we're getting external experts to come in and look at parts of the collection. So we'll go through, say, okay, all the birds, these are all the birds that we have. You know, we got a pretty good understanding about some of them, but we don't know everything about all of them. So let's try to get some experts in who are specialised just in birds and who can bring that extra level of knowledge to the table and say, well, okay, this specimen is particularly important because of this, or this collector who collected this specimen is very important because of this. Things that we might not know just off the top of our heads that we'd have to do a lot of research to understand better. And obviously, we don't have the time to do that sort of level of research for 250,000 objects. But the whole thing is been funded by the Esme Fairbairn, which is a funding pot which comes through the Museums Association. And so that's a very, very handy resource for us.
Well, you've brought us to the issue of funding, and in fact that's a neat link into the story of the consultation that's been going on, particularly in North London, North West London. And this, I think, affects you directly, doesn't it, Jeff?
Amazingly so. I live in what I shall refer to in a moment as the black spot, and I wasn't aware of this until I was literally handed a leaflet. It was walking down Ealing Broadway. I live in Ealing, Acton, and a few months ago, and it was about the local A&E department being closed in Ealing, and I thought, oh, that's a shame. And I remember thinking, but I know that there's Central Middlesex Hospital, which is up towards in the Park Royal area. I remember thinking, that's okay. If I break my leg, I can hop on the bus to that. Literally hop on the bus. I should point out, the last time I went to my Ealing A&E, because I sliced my hand open, I did get on the bus to go there because I don't have a car. And so I had this like towel wrapped around my hand, bleeding as I got on. And but then it came to light. And this, I think, is the very key point, is that I think people are saying that I didn't realise that five A&E departments in the West and Northwest area of London. I can tell you, if you don't know, it's not just Ealing. So Ealing, Hammersmith, which actually is sort of near White City, Charing Cross, which is nowhere near Charing Cross, Central Middlesex Hospital. It's basically they're whittling down nine A&E departments to just five, so we're losing four. But it means that there's this map up here, and there's a map on the London website, that if you live in sort of the West 3, West 4, West 5 area, there's like this black hole where there's just nothing, and you'd have to travel a lot further to go and get some A&E attention. And my simple thing is that I read all the news articles, and I agree there was a consultation, and some people are saying that some people weren't consulted enough and they've done it just to get the answer they want. And I'm not against change, but surely the simple thing would be to have a compromise somewhere between what's been proposed and what there is now, so that the change is a slow one. Why not just say whittle them down to two, you know, not at least retain one A&E department in that black spot, and then review it again in a year's time. And that to me is the sensible answer. And I don't like it when people go, it must be this at one extreme, and the other party go, no, it must be this at the other extreme, and nobody's prepared to meet in the middle. Why can't people meet in the middle? Am I being naive there?
No, I mean, that's to be honest, that's a very, very common problem, this whole inability to compromise. But at the end of the day, when we're talking about hospitals, I mean, we're having actually a similar problem with the Lewisham A&E. The real issue is that you're talking about people's lives. When you're talking about closing an A&E department, you're talking about when you have a heart attack. And let's face it, a lot of us will end up having heart attacks. Another minute away in an ambulance is the difference between life and death. And when you've got a massive black spot, or just a paucity of A&E departments which are able to take you, because don't forget, people are always in A&E departments. They're never empty. As soon as you close down four, all of those people that were going to the A&E department, they can't just not go. They're going to have to go somewhere. So the amount of resources that are going to have to be redirected to those other departments, the amount of in terms of space in some instances, it's a vast, vast change in the way in which those other hospitals are going to be able to function.
It's worth saying as well that there's a texture to that problem, because the A&E departments are associated with particular hospitals, and those individual hospitals have specialisms. And so when you're a trained ambulance driver, or for example the air ambulance, and you know that a patient's got a particular condition that needs to be treated quickly, then you know which A&E to go to. So I wonder how much that's been factored in. All A&E departments are not the same.
They're not. So I'm going to go off on a slight tangent, and just because I also just read some notes there, is that actually some of them, I'm not sure the actual figures, they're not completely losing the A&E, but they're going to be reduced down to what they call these minor injuries units. So they can't deal with a broken leg, but they can deal with like a nasty gash on your finger. And please don't laugh at me over such a simple thing, but I had a train analogy on this, and I likened it to the fact that when the government want to close like a train line or a branch line, they can't just close it. They whittle it down to like one train a week, which is their legal requirement or something. And then a year later, they're able to go, oh, look, no one's using it. That's our justification for closing it. And you can't help but wonder that something same is going to happen here, that they're going to whittle Ealing A&E down to just like to a minor injuries. And then they'll go, oh, look, hardly anyone's going there. Well, of course not, because you've closed the main reason for going there. And then they'll be able to go, well, let's close it all together. And I think that there's a little bit
what's the word, subterfuge going on there. It's a nasty way of getting what they want in a very cynical fashion. That's what I worry about.
Let's change the subject abruptly to getting what you want in an entirely honest way. Well, there's a new shop over... it's on the river, isn't it?
I love this. Let's be cheerful. So I feel like I've been very cynical and mean, and so I want to bring some cheer to the podcast, and you can hear the love in my voice. This is brilliant, and not just because it's a bus. There is a bus-based honesty shop in St Catherine Docks, and the Londoner's article rather amusingly pointed out that it might not work in Peckham, but it works in the rather swanky St Catherine Dock. And basically, it's a pop-up based shop that's in a bus. You literally get on a bus, you can go down there. They sell knitted clothing, gardening tools, kitchenware, but basically there's no checkout, there's nobody to take your money. Things are priced, but on your way out, it's hoped that you're genteel enough, as it says, to put the money in an honesty envelope and post it into the letterbox without being asked. So they're expecting you to buy stuff without being, you know, actually asked for the money. It's up to you. I think it's great. I'm going to go down at the weekend and check it out.
I have seen the speed with which an armchair can be deposited on a pavement. And the gap between that and a guy with a van who clearly doesn't live in the area but just patrols looking for armchairs, snatches it up off the street, tells me that there are people who are just waiting for an opportunity like this.
Well, I think it'll work in certain areas of London, and it will sound terribly snobbing, as they say. It might not work in Peckham, and it probably does work in St Catherine. So if it is a success, and it would be great, wouldn't it, to see some figures as to how much money, if any, they're actually losing, then I'm sure the bus can drive to other affluent parts of towns.
Well, now hold on, we've got to challenge this. So what are we saying? Affluent people are honest, or you can't trust South Londoners, or what? I mean, this is outrageous.
I'd say that affluent people are probably less bothered about spending money, although actually that's probably a lie as well. That's probably not true. I think everyone's bothered about spending money. It's just whether you got it in the first place.
Fundamentally, is this going to work?
I don't know. As a scientist, I'd say we have to find out.
I would say that in the, and again, I hate to use this phrase, but in the current economic climate, I would be surprised if it would work more than it did, say, 10 years ago. But who knows? You know, stranger things have happened.
Interesting, wouldn't it, to see what sort of stuff is getting nicked, whether the profile of things that get pinched has changed because of the economic situation?
I actually want to see some stats. Somebody, I don't know who's in charge of this, but I would love to see stats of how much has been invested, how much they've made, what's being stolen. Is it worthwhile? I would love a full-up story on this in 6 months' time with raw statistics.
We've got a lovely stats story to do with crimes in just a second. We'll be finding out how monks figure in the statistics. First, though, I've got to ask you whether you'd like an audio book, because if you would, you can have one for free. Oh yes, and it's on audible.co.uk, courtesy of Londonist. You can select a free digital audiobook from 60,000 titles offered by Audible. All you need to do is sign up for a 30-day free trial of the Audible service. And after that, I think it's somewhere between about £4 and £5, something along those lines, per month. And you can download an audio book every month for that. And this is great, actually, because you can put them on your iPhone or iPad or your MP3 player. You can burn it to a CD. This is your book to keep, and the free one as well for the trial period. You get to keep that forever, whether you stay with Audible or not. And all you need to do to get that is just go to www.audible.co.uk/Londonist and click through. And I've got to say, that might not be a bad Christmas present for someone as well. Monks. Paolo Viscardi.
Yeah, it's a slightly odd article, really. It's about Section 5, which is a bit of law which protects you against rowdy or kind of uncouth behaviour, which I think basically means that if someone insults you or if they're being very noisy or whatever, you can call the police on them. And so there's the Metropolitan Police released a list of people who are victims of Section 5 public order offences since 2003. And it's an interesting bunch of people, actually. So there are lots of, about 2,000 school children and 1,638 students were victims. It's quite odd because you tend to think of those as being the likely guilty parties. So. Yeah,
particularly those from Peckham.
Well, yes, I kind of like Peckham, so I'm not entirely sure that's fair, but at the same time, yeah, absolutely.
You wouldn't get any pop-up buses there, though, would you, really, in Peckham?
No, but you do get some good pop-up bars there. There's that. What's the name of it? I can never remember.
On top of the car park.
On top of the car park. Yeah. What's it called again?
Is it Frank's? Or
Frank's. Frank's. That's it. Frank's. Yeah. It's probably closed now because it's winter. But yeah, fantastic. The views from up there are just incredible.
Well, in fact, if it's drunken disorderly behaviour, I don't know if we should be bringing that into the same article here. We've got lots of... I mean, this is disgraceful, actually. 5,000 police employees, 600 employees of the ambulance service. I have to say sad, but you wouldn't be entirely surprised to hear that they're encountering drunken disorderly type behaviour. But this is disgraceful. 22 fire service staff were targeted by people in that frame of mind. And then we get onto the really weird the weird stuff, and you have to kind of concoct a mental picture as to how these things happen.
Well, judges you can totally understand, and you can understand why they might get a bit of abuse. In fact, I'm surprised there's so few judges. Astronomers, again, I can imagine if you're traipsing around in the middle of the night with a big telescope, you might get a little bit of abuse thrown at you by a drunkard.
Oi, you're looking at my planet.
Yeah, exactly. Or you know, are you a pervert? You know, there's houses over there. You've got a telescope. It looks a bit dodgy, you know.
Oh, that was well thought through.
There you go. You can come up with good reasons.
That's a nice view you've got from your window.
Yeah, you should see the view out the other side.
Well, the tower block over there.
No, the...
With all the bedrooms, isn't it?
No. Okay, where were we? There's a monk and nuns, three nuns apparently. It says they claimed they were a monk and nuns. I don't think there was any proof that they were a monk and nuns.
Why do we disbelieve that they were a monk and nuns?
I have absolutely no idea. I'm sure they probably were.
We haven't doubted the astronomer in the same way.
Well, I think we kind of casted some potential aspersions on the astronomer's character there with the telescope.
I see, yes. Yes, what else have we got?
Butchers and bakers. I'm surprised that actually there are only 9 butchers and 12 bakers. I would have thought there'd be more butchers because some people do have a very strong dislike for people who eat meat and provide it as a source of sustenance. So I'm surprised there aren't more kind of right-on vegan activists who were shouting abuse at butchers. When I was at college, I knew a guy who actually was put in prison for a while for setting fire to a butcher's shop because he was so anti. So
it's a barbecue, surely.
Well, good call. Yeah, kind of wish I'd been there now. But yeah, so there are some people out there who are a little bit unhinged when it comes to butchers.
See, the thing is, I would have thought that the number would be higher for bakers because if you're thinking about who to target, you've got one guy with a baking tray or one guy with a cleaver.
Just while we're talking about butcher shop, this is completely tangential, but there are these little pop-up shops around Forest Hill and Sydenham, which have been going on recently. They got a Portus Award. And a butcher suddenly materialised in Forest Hill the other day. I was taken aback, and it's great. You know, it's exactly the kind of thing which you need coming on the run-up to Christmas, a butcher. Just suddenly popping up out of nowhere. Fantastic. So no abuse for them, I don't think. Oh, and apparently chimney sweeps get abused. That's two chimney sweeps.
I didn't know there even were two chimney sweeps.
Is that still a profession? Is that still
people? I believe so.
Wow, okay.
On the way up here, by the way, there's an estate agent's, or what looks like an estate agent's, and you know around this time of year, businesses try to tie their business in with Christmas in some awkward way, and you can't really tie an estate agency in with Christmas in any convenient fashion. So they've tried to do that, but then they backed off from Christmas. I think they've got scared that they're being a little bit religion specific or something like that. So they've got a notice outside their shop that says, "Get your house evaluated in appreciation of the season," which is about as weird an advert as it gets.
That doesn't mean anything. How can you link estate agents to... Unless they've actually got Santa's Grotto for sale, then, you know, that is desperate measures, isn't it?
The only link I can see between estate agents and Christmas is there are some houses, actually, around here built by a guy called Christmas. They're called the Christmas Houses. And there's actually a flat for sale in a Christmas house in Forest Hill, which my wife and I actually had a look at the advert for just the other day. So there is a small link there, but it's pretty minimal.
Oh, they should have just gone for it and said, buy a Christmas house.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's talk about the skyline of London, since we're on buildings and architecture and that sort of stuff.
Well, sounds good to me. Yeah, we get a great view. We're here at the Horniman. I have to say, the view from the gardens, the pavilion area in our gardens, is just phenomenal. I didn't realise how good it was until I went up there on a nice clear day, and you can see London skyline with just it's absolutely fantastic. Well worth a look, I would say. And it's free, so you know, you can't really go far wrong with that.
Well, you're in an ideal position then, presumably, to comment on these beefs that the skyline is being messed up, roundly screwed.
Yeah, I don't know how you screw up a skyline, to be honest.
Well, what they say, very clear criticism here from Rowan Moore, architecture critic of the Observer newspaper. He is saying that they're spreading the big buildings out too widely. He wants them clustered in a little group, and they're not being clustered at all. They're being spread all over. They're ill-advised, undistinguished. He's not happy.
Well, I personally would like to see it all as fields and forests, because I like fields and forests. So we can never get quite what we want on our skyline. I just think it's a bit silly. You know, London's a big organic place. You have developments going on all over the shop. Different areas of London change their usage. Different areas of London have different kind of priorities at different times. You get clusters of buildings of a different kind of style at different times, because that's the area where you would be building those sorts of buildings at a particular given point in history. It's all about evolution. It's about how the skyline evolves. And at the moment, there might be these big kind of skyscrapers going up in various different patches and whatever else that don't seem cohesive. But because of the way in which kind of cities develop and economics works, there will be more places springing up around them. Well, assuming there's ever any money again, but there will be more places spring up around, and because of, you know, simply the fact that those will be the desirable areas to do it, they'll continue to do that.
I think as long as you can access the places that are clogging up the skyline, I'll explain that comment logically now, then it's okay. For example, like, am I right in thinking that to go up the Shard right now, it costs quite a few quid, right? You can't just go there for free. Whereas, for example, I mentioned earlier I was at the Museum of London at the weekend, and we came out, we walked down to St Paul's station along Cheapside, and suddenly I turned to my girlfriend, I went, oh yes, let me show you something, and I don't want to plug it, but there, yeah,
where does this story go? Yeah,
but there's I won't mention the shopping centre, but there's a brand new shopping centre right next to St Paul's Cathedral, and another London blogger a few months ago showed me this. And if you go into sort of where the mall is, and there's lifts that take you between the first and second floor, there's like a secret, he says in quotes, button that takes you up to the seventh floor, because there's no third, fourth, fifth, sixth floor, and there's a balcony on top, and you get out, and it takes you right next to, you know, the domed part of St Paul's Cathedral, and an amazing view. And we went there at 4 o'clock, just as it was getting dusk, and you literally step out of the lift, and my girlfriend went, wow. And it's just kind of, and it's this beautiful scene. So that's the Londonist out loud hot tip for the week, is to go up to the seventh floor in the shopping centre next to St Paul's and just look at the view. It's stunning.
If you hadn't already earned your place on the show, by golly, you would have just done so with that. You can stage your own Affair to Remember scene right next to St Paul's, thanks to Jeff Marshall. Well, what about the architecture underground, though? There's some new stations that have popped up, particularly in the east of town.
I love how you seamlessly link things together. Your brain just links stuff together. It's fantastic. You want to talk about the plans for transport in London over the next 10 years, don't you? And the fact that fares are going up yet again. Am I correct?
By Jove, that's a good idea.
TfL did this great thing this week, which they always do. They always, in my mind, they repackaged news which has already been used, and they go, look, here's all these amazing things that we're doing. And they sort of, and they covered up the fact that there was a new story out that fares are going to rise by more than inflation every year for the next 10 years by saying, but look all the things that we're doing, and then announce the whole bunch of things that they already told us we were doing, such as the new Victoria Line ticket halls, which are opening, and Crossrail and Tottenham Court Road. And so I remember thinking, looking at their press release, thinking, this is great, but there was actually nothing new on there yet. In fact, the only one thing which was a bit of new information was the fact that something wasn't happening, and that's the fact that the tram link extension to Crystal Palace has they're saying that that's definitely not happening yet. So there's nothing actually new on there. So except for the fare rises, which again, and I'm going to go off on a slight tangent here, but this is relevant, and I saw this just earlier this week on Tuesday. I was in the new King's Cross ticket hall, because being a geek, I went out to check out the new King's Cross station, and I had to run back home, so I didn't get a chance to read the poster properly. But there was a poster up saying, you know, I think targeted at tourists, mainly saying, are you done with your Oyster card? Pop it in here into this charity box. And we all know, because there have been stories before, that TfL have a lot of redundant money sitting on Oyster cards. People come along, they put £10 in their card, and at the end of their trip, they leave London, and there's still like £2.50 or £3 on there unspent. And if you add all this up, it's like millions of pounds worth of money that's been paid that sort of floating in the system doing nothing. Reminds me of Superman 3, where Brewster got all the spare pennies, didn't he? All the cents, and he credited himself with all these millions. And from what I could gather, they were saying, donate your Oyster card and we'll give the money to charity, which of course is a great thing. No one's knocking charities, but I bet if you polled Londoners and said, what would you like to do with all the spare millions floating around, they'd go, knock it off fares for everybody so that the fares don't rise next year. And that, I think, would be a smarter idea. Just had to get that off my chest.
Well, I nearly agree with that line of thinking, but if these are people who are visiting the capital and leaving their money behind, I don't mind it. I think it should go to a charity. I don't quite see why we should get a couple of quid off.
My opinion on that is that a lot of the tourists who come to the country and come into London, buy an Oyster card, will come round and they'll go to all of the museums and they'll have a lovely time and it'll be fantastic. Great. Any other country you go to, you pay to go to their museums. We have free museums. We are bringing tourists into the country for museums. They are spending their money. It's going into the economy. It's great. That's what we want. And they're getting a good experience at the end of it. Fantastic. As far as I'm concerned, the unpaid money on their Oyster card can be viewed as money that they've basically not had to pay for going to the museum. Let's chuck it back into the system. I quite like the idea of knocking it off Oyster cards, because quite frankly, everyone I know who works in the museum has to travel in London. If you can knock it off fares, I think you should.
Well, that didn't go where I was expecting it to go. I thought you were going to angle for the cash to get another walrus.
Well, I will go back to what I said earlier. Let's have a fair compromise. Let's not have one extreme or another. Let's split the money and let's give 50% to museums or galleries, something like that, and then 50% back to the fare paying passenger. There you go, everybody's happy.
And I would say that a lot of museums and galleries are charities, so they seem like good charities to give the money to if you are going to give the money to charity.
Well, here's another good charity while we're in charity mood. The Choir With No Name is a long-time friend of Londonist Out Loud, as you know. They've got a gig coming up very, very soon at the Union Chapel. They'd love you to come along. I will pass over to Marie Benton from the Choir With No Name.
Hello, it's Marie from the Choir With No Name. The Choir With No Name runs choirs for people who've experienced homelessness. We've got three at the moment, one in North London, one in South London and one in Birmingham. So this Tuesday, the 11th of December, we are going to be at the Union Chapel in Islington for our fantastic once-a-year Christmas gig. There's going to be three Choir With No Names and also a support act called the City Shanty Band, I have to be careful how you say it, who are they sing sea shanties but about living in the city, and they're all from Hackney and they're quite funny. At our gig on the 11th of December, we've got lots of silly Christmas songs, basically, as we do every year. There's going to be a very stupid arrangement of Last Christmas. There's also some more kind of contemplative stuff, like we've got a Flaming Lips Christmas song that's going down very well in rehearsal, and lots of audience sing-along stuff, and generally a brilliant time. But yes, come, it's 12 quid and it's going to be brilliant. Doors at 7. But you can find out more from www.choirwithnoname.org.
There we go. Yes, do go onto the Choir With No Names website, or if you'd like to reserve tickets, and particularly if you are working with people who are homeless, emma@choirwithnoname.org is the email address you'll need. So that's Tuesday, 11th of December at the Union Chapel in Islington. Well, Paolo Viscardi and Jeff Marshall, we are up against the clock, as we always seem to be, and we haven't had a chance yet to talk about Boris and his adventures in India, which sounds like a novel for kids from the 50s or something, doesn't it? What's he been, just in a sentence, Jeff, what's he been up to over there?
Acting in a very Boris-esque fashion, he was on a six-day tour to promote business, to try to say, hey, Indian businesses, come to London and we'll have our business links with you. Really, he's just giving, have I got news for you, you know, fodder to have the PIRSS taken out of him. Why do you give me that? You know I'm not a Boris fan. You did this last time. You know I'm not a Boris fan. He just comes across as a buffoon, and it's a great thing, but I was just again, I'll be cynical, I was left thinking I'd rather he was back in London actually maybe doing London stuff. Aren't there other organisations that should be promoting businesses? Is it actually economically wise to be trying to promote business with India, which is half across the world? Why not do it within the existing European Union, which we have, where businesses are a lot closer? So it's not a bad thing. I just thought it was a bit of a waste of time on his part.
Well, he's more of a figurehead than, it's always difficult to know who the Lord Mayor of London is at any given point, is it? He's a noted figure, he's recognised around the world.
But I don't want Indians thinking that that's what all Londoners are like. It's that simple.
I have to say, there's a bit of a whiff about it for me of the pre-prime ministerial photograph campaign going on here, isn't it?
Good God, that's just a horrible thought. Horrible. Horrible thought.
I've got to say, a lot of times people connected with museums are quite careful about how they tiptoe around political subjects.
Yeah, I should make it very clear that I'm not speaking on behalf of the Warnham. I am representing myself. I've said it before and I'll say it again. What I say is what I think, not what my...
Well, let's finish on a subject with no controversy attached to it whatsoever. The expansion of Heathrow Airport.
Yeah, the expansion of Heathrow Airport that Boris Johnson said a couple of weeks ago was never going to happen, which I think actually he's right about. I think that's probably for the best. I can see arguments for the expansion of Heathrow being, you know, yes, it will potentially make, well, it will make jobs and so on, but at the end of the day, Heathrow is not a good place for an airport. It's a highly populated area around there. I used to live not far from there. I used to be kept awake by planes taking off all hours of day and night. It is hideous. And so there's this a report by John Rentoul in the Independent blogs saying that the green case is an issue because obviously we can't cut carbon emissions by building bigger airports and putting in more runways. And also that noise pollution... Then 30% of all the people in the European Union who are affected by noise pollution actually live around Heathrow.
That's an incredible statistic.
All of the airports in the European Union, that's a vast number of people, but most of them actually live around Heathrow because it's placed so close to basically housing and where people live. So really, it's not a good place for an airport. And you can kind of see why putting another runway in there is just... a hideous idea for anyone who lives locally. And there's, you know, we're talking there about 756,000 people.
So your preferred option, well, I can't see you wanting to put an island in amongst all those nice birds in the estuary. I think you'll be a standstill expansionist.
I think it's probably better to go out. I mean, I think the main thing is to develop the infrastructure to make sure that the links between the slightly further out airports like Stansted and Luton are just better.
Or even Southend, which at first I thought was a preposterous idea, but now I'm warming to it as a London airport. That's it's good.
And anything which, so long as there's the investment to actually develop the infrastructure, it means that what you have is a better place for other people to live as well. You know, it means that you're improving transport links into London because, let's face it, people from London will be getting on the planes from whatever airport you go from.
And they'll be coming to London. And our Facebook question of the week was, where is the centre of London? And quite a few people have given the centre of London without any validation whatsoever. London Stone, says somebody. But why? We've no idea. Could be true. Might not be true.
I think the best one without any validation is the simplest one is just Me by Sash Cron. That's fantastic. It speaks of a real personality there.
Rick Wiltshire says the Thames. There are problems with that, Rick Wiltshire.
Yeah, the fact that it doesn't just run through London, but actually doesn't it go into Wiltshire, which is funny enough. It runs all the way west into his surname. My favourite's... sticking with the Me phase, two people have gone with, geographically speaking, it's between Elephant and Castle and Lambeth North, and because that's where I was born, I'm gonna go, yeah, it was born right by me, between Elephant and Castle and Lambeth North.
So you are the centre of London.
I am the centre of London. You are that privileged. But a lot of people just saying that it's actually... I was told it was Centre Point. Some people saying Charing Cross. But a lot of people saying the Charles I statue in Trafalgar Square.
Yes, we've actually got a picture of this sent in by Devon Simons, who says, guys, there is a plaque in Trafalgar Square, and here are my feet next to it. And we have indeed got a picture of feet and a plaque that says City of Westminster on the site now occupied by the statue of King Charles I was erected the original Queen Eleanor's Cross, a replica of which stands in front of Charing Cross Station. Mileages from London are measured from the site of the original cross. Let's pick out some other amusing ones just very quickly.
I think Charing Cross we got here officially, but of course we all know it has to be 221B Baker Street.
Yes.
Which is
yes,
nice.
Sorry, I agree. That's a great one, yes. Someone here has just said Smith London Fields, because that's where all the paths meet, apparently. And Marble Arch as well, where crossing roads without subways is only for brave men. I agree. Marble Arch would be good.
One or two London-based businesses trying to get in on the act here. London Literary Pub Crawl says the creative centre of London is obviously Fitzrovia and Soho. Well, if it's obvious, then it must be true. Treasure Trails, Greater London, says, if I draw lines on my... Now, I like this. Paolo, you'll like this as a scientific approach. If I draw lines on my big laminated map of London from the northernmost point of Enfield to a place level with the southernmost tip of Bromley, then, likewise, east-west, from the far points of Havering to Hillingdon, the intersection of the halfway points is just south of the New Kent Road next to Elephant and Castle.
Yay! Yeah.
Right on Jeff's head.
We have a winner. There we go. Right? So we're decided right now. We're saying, London is just saying, that's where it is, right? Right?
Well, we'll take that out in the edit, I think. Thank you, everyone who's contributed for that. We always have a Facebook question. If you're interested in getting your response on the show, just look out for it on the Londonist Facebook page. We must come to a close, but not before I pit the mind of Paolo Viscardi against the mind of Jeff Marshall. We've got five questions. The week in London just passed in history.
I forgot this was going to happen. I'm not going to be very good at this.
No, I've been revising.
I believe you too.
I've been too busy.
Okay, Monday, 26th of November, 1983. An armed robbery at the Brinks Mat Warehouse near Heathrow Airport becomes one of the largest heists in history, as £26 million worth of what three things is stolen?
It's got to be diamonds, right? It's got to be
diamonds is one of them.
Yes!
Bullion.
Bullion is another.
Oh, it's going to be something obscure, isn't
stocks.
It?
Stocks.
What?
Bonds.
Yeah. Not bonds.
Traveller's checks.
No, traveller's checks. Could you
cash.
Even do that?
Cash.
Yes, Paolo's got it. It's cash.
Cash. What? Oh.
Cash. One, two, Paolo. Choose.
What? Why?
Got two, you got one.
Oh.
We can't have controversy at this early stage.
66.6 to 33.3.
A third of a point, two thirds of a point, surely. Come on.
Just say.
1 week later, Tuesday, the 27th of November, but in which year? The great storm of reaches its destructive peak in London. The lengthy storm would cause extensive damage to the capital, blowing off part of the roof of Westminster Abbey, demolishing hundreds of chimneys, and causing Queen Anne to shelter in a cellar at St. James's Palace.
Can we both have a guess and the nearest year wins?
Yes, you can.
You after you?
No.
That's clever.
I'm going to say 1673.
Are you now?
I'm going to say 1682.
Another point to Paolo. It's 1703. Wednesday, the 28th of November, 1999. A naked man bursts into a church in Thornton Heath, South London. What happens next?
I apologise. Sorry.
He gets shot.
No. He
by a monk.
He'd been held hostage or something around the corner in a house, and this was his chance to escape, and he ran to the church.
Well, there's lots of exciting violent stuff going on here. You're right with the violence, but wrong with all the answers so far.
A hostage? Was
there a sword involved?
Yes, there was a sword involved.
Oh, okay, I think I might vaguely recall this. But I can't remember what it was. I remember a naked man and a sword. That's all I can remember.
Well, that'll do us. He was wielding a samurai sword and indiscriminately attacking the congregation. 11 people injured, some very seriously, before he was overpowered. The attacker would later be found not guilty of attempted murder and assault for reasons of insanity and detained at a psychiatric hospital. This is looking good for Paolo at this stage.
I'm losing 3-0, aren't I? Again, I lost last time. I'm rubbish. Why do you have me on? Don't ever invite me back.
Let me just write that down.
I didn't do any revision. I think I'm doing all right, yeah.
Yeah, all right. That's making him feel good, isn't it? Thursday, the 29th of November, 1773, an attorney's clerk named Foster Powell sets off on a journey on foot from London to York and back. He would complete his round trip in how long? This has got to appeal to you, Jeff.
I suppose I should guess first, shouldn't I?
I guess first.
I would... it's a round trip from here to York.
Here to York on foot.
On foot. And is a clerk. Okay. Let me think. Can we just...
I'm intrigued that's going to affect your answer.
Well, yeah. It's not like he's a long-distance runner or something along those lines. I would say... That's what? Three? 3 days.
At least 2 weeks.
Paolo's got it again.
No!
It's 6 days.
What?
There you go.
A round trip, there and back. He walked to York in 3 days and back again.
Yeah, you can easily do it.
This was back
they had muddy paths, didn't they? Have, you know, nice urban.
Jeff Marshall is not taking it well.
No, I'm not. I protest vehemently.
Final question. Last chance. Friday, the 30th of November, 1936. What is destroyed by fire?
Could we have the year again, sorry?
That's 1936.
Something in London?
It's a London show.
I know. Just.
Something's destroyed by fire. God knows. 1936.
Is it something which is so very famous? It's going to be something like the Albert Hall and they've rebuilt it. No, was it one of the Lord's cricket grounds?
No, but you're in the right sort of neck of the. You've got the right sort of idea.
With cricket or with the Albert Hall? You've just nodded, which?
Yeah, one of those, yep.
I think you're going to get this point.
I'm going to go with the Albert Hall. So it's something along those lines. I don't know. It's going to be a famous London landmark that we never knew burnt down and was rebuilt. But it's just a case of which one it was.
Well, it wasn't. I don't think it was rebuilt. There is a bit of South London that's named after it. And it was originally, I think, in Hyde Park and got moved to
Crystal Palace.
Of course it was.
I thought Crystal Palace ages ago and never said anything.
I'm leaving the building. Oh, God.
Well, if ever you want to hurry Jeff Marshall out of a room, and that's the way to do it. You got your backside pummeled there, didn't you?
It's not fair. You make me look out to be incompetent and stupid, and I'm not.
It's all right, you're the centre of London. Well, as Jeff licks his wounds and Paolo's giving him a lovely pat on the back. That's really nice. Yes, I saw the knife go in behind Paolo. That's where we have to tie off. We should give some of the details of websites and museums and that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
In all honesty, the one thing that I didn't know is where on earth the Horniman Museum is, because Forest Hill is way, way off my map. So I don't know, for us north or east Londoners, perhaps we need a bit of guidance to get here.
Yeah, I mean, Forest Hill is actually, nowadays with the existence of the Overground, it's actually really easy to get to. So it's in Forest Hill. The Horniman's just up the hill in Forest Hill. And there's the Overground, which connects straight into to Forest Hill. It's really easy. So you can get on there from the Jubilee line, from the Hammersmith and City line, from the District line, from the DLR, from the Victoria line at the top end in Highbury and Islington. So there's loads of ways to actually get here. You can connect up very easily, and there's loads of buses.
And as from this Sunday, here's the generic transport plug. The new Overground link is coming in between Clapham Junction and Surrey Quays, and you can change. That's opening in 2 days' time on Sunday. I'll be on one of the first trains. I'm not going to plug my website, but I'm going to say, yes, I love the Horniman, I love museums. I'm going to give a general plug for museums and say, Londoners, if you're stuck with something to do, but that's not Christmas shopping this weekend, go to a museum. There we go.
What about your app that would possibly help people to get here?
I didn't want to plug. Well, you can buy it. If you have one of those devices that starts with a small letter I, then search for the phrase Station Space Master on your store, and there's a handy guide that tells you everything about all transport tube overground things in London. Go and buy it. It's amazing. There we go. StationMasterApp.com.
And the website for the Horniman?
The Horniman website is horniman.ac.uk.
Fantastic. Well, look, thanks for hosting us today. And we're in amongst all the specimens in a lovely, musty back room, which is a nice place to end the week. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Here she stands. And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to my guests, Paolo Viscardi and Jeff Marshall. Thanks too to Bernie Barkley, Zoe Craig, Rhea Heath and Dave Haste. Theme and incidental music was by Jack Hurd and Rory Anderson. And I'm N. Quentin Wolfe. See you.